Oh, wow, that's the microphone? Wow.
Come on, you're supposed to go back. Come on. All right. This is File 63. This is Jean McMillan. Today's date is August 15th, 2017. I am interviewing Roberta Willis, who is the former Democratic State Representative of the 64th District. She's going to talk about her volunteer activities, her procedure in the legislature, and legislation that she's been particularly fond of, as well as other things that she wishes to talk about. But first, we'll start with the genealogical information. What is your name?
Roberta Willis, and I lived in Sharon growing up, and my family is from Sharon. My mother was born in Sharon at Sharon Hospital. My grandparents, Mary and Alex Galleon, came to Sharon in the early 1920s.
Your grandparents' names again?
Galleon, G-A-L-L-I-O-N.
All right. And when were you born?
March 6, 1951.
And where?
In Flushing, Queens, New York.
And your parents' names, please.
My mother's name was Clara Galleon, and my father's name was Harold Burke.
And it's B-E-R-K.
Yes, Burke is B-E-R-K.
Okay. You have siblings.
I have one sister, Sherry, who also still lives in the area, lives in Sharon, and works here in Lakeville.
And how did you come to the area?
I came because my mother's family was here. It was a rich history and love for the northwest corner of Connecticut. So I always like to say I may have been born in New York, but in actuality, I feel like this has always been home.
You're a Connecticut girl?
Yeah.
Okay. Where did you go to college?
I went to Northwestern Connecticut Community College for my associate's degree, and shortly after that, I transferred to Vassar College and graduated from there in 1979 with a degree in political science.
Aha, okay, wonderful. One of the first things that you got involved in was pesticides and food? The ALEC? LR?
Yeah. In the 80s, I read a report on pesticides in children's diets, and it was a report done by the Natural Resources Defense Council, and at that time my children were my two youngest were very small, mm-hmm, and very concerned about children's health. So a group of us, about 25 Salisbury women, formed Mothers and Others for a Livable Planet, which was really about addressing the issue of toxins in food. And the fact that the government, the issue at hand was that the government regulated toxins by testing tolerances of adult men, never took into consideration child development or a body weight of a small child and what that could possibly have that effect on them. So that group of 25 women grew into a national organization of about 40,000
Good heavens.
Across the country. My neighbor, our neighbor here in Salisbury, Meryl Streep, joined me in that effort. And I joined her. Anyway, the two of us. And these other women really became quite activists. And I think pretty much changed the way America eats. Mm-hmm. Organic became much more prevalent. You couldn't mm-hmm. find it, really, in the northwest corner when we started.
Mm-hmm. Unless you grew it yourself.
Exactly. And so that was that really launched me. I was always concerned about the environment, but that really got me involved in environmental health issues and really showing how people can make a difference with what we do, our consumption patterns, what we buy, mm-hmm. What we choose to do. It does make a difference, makes a difference for all of us. So although I went off into government and politics, it's interesting that in the case of environmental health, it really was getting consumers to change their habits. Mm-hmm. And
you've been very successful on that.
Right. We're very proud. And I have to say that one of the things, the connections that I did have in the legislature is that I got very involved in those issues in the legislature, not only mm-hmm. environmental issues, but really farming issues and what we could do to increase agriculture in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen grow up as in Connecticut is really a promoting of local agriculture, and we see it with all the farm markets that now have propped up. Well, that was new. When we started out, there wasn't farm markets like that. And quite frankly, it was programs, state programs and state funding, that promoted a lot of those farm markets. So the ability for people, for instance, to use food stamps or seniors to get special coupons or for farmers and activist groups to be able to fund the start of a farm market. So when we started out, when I started in the legislature, there probably was only about 25 farm markets in the entire state of Connecticut. Now there's
hundreds.
hundreds, and those are official ones.
Mm-hmm.
The little ones like we have out here, you know, in Salisbury, in front of the library. Are not state. I mean, at some point you might grow into that. Like Norfolk has a very active and large, much larger farm market, and there you can purchase a lot of items, and that does has received state funding. And you can use your food stamps and so forth when you go there. So
okay.
That's the difference, really.
Before we get into the legislative part...
Sorry.
No, this is wonderful. Tell me about the youth... Salisbury. Housatonic Youth Bureau.
Okay.
Did you get involved with that one?
The Housatonic Youth Service Bureau, that was around the same time, 1990, mm-hmm. actually. It started, so it's been over 25 years, and it really started with a group of us that included Reverend Tabor of the Congregational Church at the time, and Dr. Richard O'Connor, who was the head of the Housatonic Mental Health Center, some school guidance counselors and psychologists, and a group of concerned citizens basically sat down 27 years ago and said, we need something for our young people. You know, there's issues here, mm-hmm. families that are in crisis, kids that are struggling with issues. There's families that are struggling with substance abuse. And not enough services available. So certainly Dick O'Connor and Dick Tabor saw that right up close.
Oh, sure.
And personal. And they knew that there was not enough available services and that we needed something else. Plus, we really were offering counseling and support services free of charge to the community, which we still, the youth service still does. So it has expanded its services. We have a beautiful new facility at Housatonic Valley Regional High School right next door. And with counselors and a staff of people ready to assist families and children.
When the mental health service center was opened, that was geared more toward adults than children.
Correct. And this really...
this served the need of the young people that we didn't
Right,
have.
Because a lot of times it wasn't really a mental health issue. It really was a family in crisis that needed support services. Or a young person who was struggling with depression or was having trouble in school or had issues that... Or even parents who didn't know how to... We did parenting seminars, too, for a while.
Yeah.
Because kids are not born with instruction manuals.
Well, I wish they were.
But they're not. And therefore, families need guidance. And so we sometimes would bring in guest speakers or professional counselors to speak to the community. But right now... the staff has really grown in size over the 27 years, so we can offer more services to more families.
You're still on the board on this?
No, I'm not. I'm trying to think when I got off. I was on it for a good 20 years, but I felt I had...
You had other things to move on
well,
to.
Well, they were... They're asking, you know, for me to come back on, but I think I need a hiatus from a lot of things that I was working on. So, and they have a lot of great people there. They don't need me anymore.
Oh, but it's always nice to have the knowledge and the history.
Yeah.
And that's what you can provide that other people can't, because you were in at the beginning.
Right.
You know, don't sell yourself short.
Okay.
Ever.
Okay.
Ever. What was the first local board that you went on to from here in town? Was it PNC?
Yeah, I was PNC, probably in the mid-80s, and a lot of land development issues were going on at that time. It was a busy time.
How long were you on that?
Not very long. I would say three, 4 years. I really was in that vicinity.
And then you moved on...
Well, I started, what happened then is, at those point, my kids were really small, and P&Z met at night.
So you could...
Yeah, and I still had to work in the morning and take care of four kids. So
it worked time-wise.
Yeah. So it wasn't unusual for our meetings to go to 11 o'clock. Yeah, those were busy times, and so you can...
Well,
can't keep up that pace.
Sometimes the meetings still are 2-3 hours long. I've been just doing John Higgins, and he says, yeah, 3-hour meetings are getting a little tough.
Yeah, right, exactly. Actually, I was on, I think, when we changed the meeting time from 7:30 back to 5:30, because a 3-hour, 4-hour meeting meant that you were going right up to midnight. And
That's hard to get up the next morning.
Exactly.
When did you become state representative?
In 2000. I was elected in 2000 and served until January of 2017.
Tell me about your interview with the Speaker of the House and the lady that was the Speaker of the House.
Then. Oh, okay. Well, when I was first elected, the Speaker of the House was Maura Lyons. And she was the first Speaker of the House, woman Speaker of the House, in Connecticut history. So that was interesting in and of itself. There had never been anyone in that leadership role. And there hasn't been since. She called me in to meet with me about what my committee's assignments would be. And given when I gave the next, told her education that I, you know, was in the school system, about the Youth Service Bureau, how I went to a local community college. Next thing I knew, I was assigned to the Education Committee, the Environment Committee, and the Children's Committee, which were a perfect fit for me. And then later on in my next term, she made me chair a higher education committee in Connecticut. And I served in that capacity for the rest of my tenure in the legislature.
Well, that would be about 15 years.
Yes.
Long time. There are two sessions, a long session and a short session. Would you describe them and how they're different?
Okay. First session, legislators are elected, the same in state legislators, both in the House and in the Senate, are elected in the same years that the United States House of Representatives, so every 2 years. The first year of your term goes, when you're actually in session, goes from January to June. And then in the second year of your term, it's February to May. And it's been like that for hundreds of years.
Forever.
Forever.
Okay. So, what are some of the legislation that you've worked on? And I'm asking specifically about the small town economic assistance.
Oh, right. Well, there's two, I think, major pieces of legislation that I worked on that have had an impact on our towns. And the first one, I would say, is the Community Investment Act.
I have that number, too, because I didn't know which way they went.
Well, they're both equally. The Community Investment Act is interesting because what we did is we brought together a coalition of groups. It started out mostly aimed at, we thought, farmland preservation and open space investment fund. But in order to gain enough support, we had to reach out to other groups, and which was really, in hindsight, it made it easier to pass the legislation, but it really was very visionary, I think. And in some respects, probably one of the most visionary pieces of legislation that we've passed in recent years. And what it does is it sets up a funding mechanism, permanent funding mechanism, to fund open space preservation, farmland preservation, affordable housing, and historic preservation. And the funding comes through a fee on property transfers that take place in a community. Some of the money, small part goes to the town, directly to the town, but the rest goes into this community investment account. And there are many tracts of land in the northwest corner that have been saved through that. Farms, where the state has been able to help preserve. It also, not only, I always like to say, it's very nice to save farmland, but you have to save farmers.
Yes.
You know? And farmland's not going to do you any good.
If you don't have the farm.
If you don't have a farm. So the Community Investment Act has mechanisms in it that also fund programs, incentive programs for farmers that directly help farmers. So they need it. So if they want to build a barn or a greenhouse.
Mm-hmm. Or buy a piece of equipment.
Well, yeah.
That's expensive.
Right. And they can do that. It helps with the farm markets that I mentioned previously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It also has a subsidy in there for dairy farms.
I was hoping.
Yes. We were losing dairy farms by the hundreds in Connecticut. So when we passed the Community Investment Act and the dairy subsidy, that really stopped the hemorrhaging
mm-hmm.
of farms. And I have to say it's really impressive that in the last, I'm going to say around 10 years, we have increased the number of farms by 22% in Connecticut. We're highest in New England. And a lot of that is really a result of all the innovative programs
mm-hmm.
that we've been able to put forward that help farmers. So I'm very pleased with that. The other bill that I worked on that's the law is the Small Town Economic Assistance Program. And that I worked on in my first term in office because many of us who represented, legislators who represented small towns, felt that unlike cities, that we didn't get economic assistance and we needed to see what we could do to level the playing field. So we established the Small Town Economic Assistance Program, commonly referred to as STEAP, and it is used by communities to fund initiatives that they may not have local funding available to them. So it could be a town project, could be the library needing help, it could be a firehouse, and I think the Lakeville Hose Company got
they did.
Small town economic assistance
they did.
Money. Daycare centers, Falls Village got, they were one of the first in the state to take advantage
mm-hmm.
of a STEAP grant, and they got it to start the Falls Village Daycare Center. So there's, again, that's $500,000 a year max per town that you're eligible for. It doesn't mean you're going to get it or if there's enough money to go around. But it is there for communities, small towns.
Would that cover gravestone preservation within the town?
I'm not sure. I mean, that would be...
Because there's a LOSIP grant, which we haven't gotten yet because of the state budget, but looking down the road for other ways to get money to do stone restoration.
I would think LOSIP makes more sense.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean you don't have a conversation.
Okay. But it's
with
something
somebody
to think about.
Yeah, I mean, it's a possibility. I have not seen that done.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the challenge might be that it's not town property.
But it is.
Oh, it is? Well, then you probably should.
Because
but
there are 5 out of the 12 that are town owned.
Well, the thing about LOSIP is the town gets that money and it can decide what it can
yeah.
do.
Yeah.
When you do a STEAP grant, you have
it's
to...
It's designated.
Well, first the town has to vote.
Uh-huh. Okay.
That they're going to apply for it for that project.
Okay.
And you might have... 3 projects that you know, some towns don't
okay.
submit any in a year,
mm-hmm.
but they can't add up to more than 500,000.
Okay. But it's information for
right,
me.
Right.
Which is what I need. Which I need.
You wouldn't close the door on it.
Oh, no.
I'm
out there begging everybody.
Right.
You work very hard on the Sharon Hospital business.
Yes.
Tell us about that, please.
Well, Sharon Hospital, first of all, had has a special place in my heart because my mom was born there, as I said, and all four of my children were born in Sharon Hospital, and two of my grandchildren were born in Sharon Hospital. Mm. So we sort of have a...
You've got a connection there.
We definitely have a connection to the Sharon Hospital. It is really the most rural hospital in the state of Connecticut. And before I was elected, right before, Sharon Hospital was grappling with some serious fiscal challenges. Operating monies lacked the capital monies to make the improvements. You know, you couldn't have raised that much money for operating from the community. So some tough decisions had to be made. And the board of Sharon Hospital decided to opt for a hospital system that was a for-profit called Essent Healthcare. And that was challenging because it was the only nonprofit hospital to become a for-profit. So there's no precedent. No. But fortunately, there was a law on the books in Connecticut that governed the possible transfer or change from a not-for-profit to a for-profit. Thank goodness for our community, because that's where I came in. I worked with, at that time, Attorney General Richard Blumenthal, who's now our U.S. Senator, and the Office of Healthcare Access to develop really a contract with Essent, with all kinds of conditions that needed to be met. One of them was to establish a community health foundation. So Foundation for Community Health was formed with the proceeds of the sale. So that money would always be used to benefit people in all of our communities, the 17 towns that make up the catchment area for Sharon Hospital. Very important. It was a leap of faith for us to become a for-profit. It was... I had a tremendous... that was very difficult for me to make the decision that I did, and that was to fully go full out and make sure this happened. Thankfully, because if we hadn't done that, we probably would have lost our hospital. And now here...
There isn't anything else.
Well, there isn't. And what's wonderful is, as of July... or August, I'm trying to think it was. So just in the last couple of weeks, the agreement was signed to transfer ownership from what was Essent Healthcare Sharon Hospital to HealthQuest, which is Vassar Brothers in Poughkeepsie. So Sharon Hospital will now return as a not-for-profit community-based hospital with strong affiliations with a larger healthcare network, which will increase the services and the number of providers that we have. So it really turned out in the end to be a win-win situation. And I worked on helping to facilitate the conversations between the hospital, the foundation, which helped make this happen, and HealthQuest. So I really applaud everyone who works so hard to keep the doors of Sharon Hospital opened as an incredible community resource.
Oh, it is.
And
it is.
We feel very fortunate. But it took
a lot of work.
It was a lot of work. Okay. Not for the faint of heart.
having been in the hospital for the first time ever, going to Sharon Hospital, and everyone was very professional. They were caring. They knew what they were doing. And I was incredibly impressed with the hospital. So I can't think of anything nicer to say about it.
No, that's wonderful, and that's what it's all about. And I think the fact that, you know, in all these small towns that our neighbors and friends work there.
Yep.
So it's quite a support system when you get picked up by the ambulance squad that knows you.
Yes.
And then you get driven to the hospital and the doors open in the ER, and then you know half the people, you know, in the ER. It's very comforting to the patient and the family.
When the call came in for me to go to the hospital, Brian Bartram, who was one of my sixth graders, heard the call, and he came specifically to make me comfortable with the ambulance. I got to the ER, and I was chatting with one of the ladies, and she remembered my husband when he was a volunteer there.
See, I rest my case.
It's perfect.
Right.
It's perfect. There was another area that you worked on for local. Was it something to do with Litchfield County?
Yes. Actually, that's another issue that I started when I was elected, day one. And it is coming to fruition next week.
Oh, good.
The Litchfield County Courthouse in Litchfield, beautiful structure, iconic structure on the green, built in the 19th century, really had come, its time had come and gone. So it was not safe. It really couldn't handle the volume.
No, it couldn't.
The court system was divided up all over, you know, juvenile courts one place, the GA court somewhere, and then Bantam had another court. Yeah. So everybody was split up, and we needed a courthouse. Going back to when Ella Grasso was governor. So this was not a new thing. What was the challenge was the conflict. It wasn't an armed conflict, but it came close, between Litchfield and Torrington of who was going to get the new courthouse.
Really? Oh, dear.
So, this battle waged for years. I got elected, and obviously the courthouse was being ruled, you know, unsafe, and it was like cease and desist. People shouldn't have been occupying it anymore, and that's what we were dealing with. But we couldn't find a home. Half of the people in Litchfield didn't want it in a great big 100,000 square foot building, and rightfully so, in Litchfield. And the other half wanted it very much to stay in Litchfield. And, of course, Torrington felt, since it was the regional center of Litchfield County, that it made the most sense that it be in Torrington. Unfortunately, what the problem was, that there actually was a law that said the courthouse could only be built in Litchfield.
Ooh.
So my task was to change the law so it could be built in some place other than Litchfield. And again, going back to my environmental roots and concerns, I felt a structure of this size belongs in a more urban setting. Access to transportation and density of population and needs, it made sense all the way around that, you know, a piece of open space should not be gobbled up to put this huge structure on. So, that was in 2000. Fast forward to August 2017, and I am getting to go on Thursday for a tour in the Litchfield County Courthouse, which has now been completed. And next week, the judges and staff will be moving into their new $81 million courthouse. And it is beautiful, so I'm very anxious. It's on Field Street in Torrington. So it's relatively close to the downtown.
But that's wonderful.
In the downtown. It is wonderful. So I'm very excited.
Oh, you should be.
Excited about that. So I've been kidding people that I'm going to scratch my name in the foundation.
Oh, you should.
Stick my foot in some cement.
How about a star?
Yeah, exactly.
You have a star.
Absolutely. That was...
My timing is quite good on this one. I'm quite
right.
Pleased.
I've had two things, Sharon Hospital and the courthouse are all coming together. Right.
Well, I'm pleased too.
Yeah.
Now, you were on the Higher Education Committee for 15 years.
Right.
And something came out of that that pleased you very much, that your colleagues named a scholarship for you.
They did.
Tell me about that, please.
Well, this was a huge surprise, to say the least. I had no idea. I had worked on legislation to change the way financial aid for our public and private universities is structured in Connecticut. And while I was on the floor of the House delivering and presenting the legislation and what it would do, describing it, the intent and purpose of the changes, one of my colleagues got up and said she had an amendment to my a bill, and I was not just taken back, I was very irritated because, you know, when you're going to do that, you usually come to the chair of the committee to say, you know, we're going to, you know, I really would like to change the legislation. And this was a woman.
Channels.
Right. And plus, this woman had worked on the bill with me. And she was chair of the Appropriations Committee, so very much involved in higher education funding and how financial aid would be structured and how much money would be in the account.
Mm-hmm.
So very much aware of what I was trying to do to get more financial aid to the most needy students. Mm-hmm. That was the intent of my change, was to get financial aid dollars to make it possible for low-income students to get a degree,
mm-hmm.
a higher education degree. So she got up and she introduced that they were changing the name of the scholarship program to the Roberta B. Willis Scholarship Program. And I still didn't understand what was happening. And finally, I don't know, at some point it sunk in, but it was quite a moment. So,
and quite an accolade
very good.
From your colleagues to wish this for you.
Well, that was really very generous of them. I always felt...
Yeah, well deserved.
It's kind of embarrassing, but...
It shouldn't be.
But anyway, it was not.
You put a lot of work in, and it's nice to have it acknowledged, because your colleagues are the ones that know how much work you put in. And that means a great deal.
No, and that was the part that they did that, you know. So, anyway.
I asked you before how government has changed over the 17 years that you've worked there. And you gave me three excellent reasons.
There you go. Let's see if I can remember them. The first one is, I would say, the the changes and the impact of social media that did not exist when I was first elected in 2000. In 2000, I don't even think I had a cell phone yet. I think my first term, I may have gotten one because I thought...
You needed it.
I needed it. But it was not considered a necessary...
Not then.
No. In fact, you couldn't get reception up here at all.
Still can't.
Well, you still can't, but back then it was it was really ridiculous. In fact, we didn't have much internet service out here.
No, no.
That was another issue I'm still working on, actually. So there was no internet, really, to speak. It was very limited. There was no cell or texting or whatnot. So the way people communicated with their legislator was different. How information gets out there is different. And it's also people have, I don't want to say instant gratification, but you send out a text to me or an email to your legislator, you think,
yeah, I want it in the next 30 seconds.
Right.
And it's not doable.
Not when you're dealing with hundreds and hundreds of people in a single day.
No.
So that's changed. It also, I find that the tenor became less civil. And I think what I said to you is when you sit down and write a letter, which you would have done in 2000, or you actually call the person on the phone, or meet with them, those were the three options at that point. It's different, and so you may be really angry, and you write a letter, and the next morning you look at it,
and you
say, I don't think I should send this.
Yeah.
I sort of got that out of my system. Well, now that...
You do an email and you send it, and
you
it's
hit
like,
that click.
Oh.
Yeah, how many times have you hit send and you go, oh,
I
shouldn't have, but I did.
Yeah.
Or maybe I should have changed it.
Yeah.
So you don't have time to reread it or edit it or...
Have second thoughts about your choice of words.
Right. You know, that control part of your brain that says, maybe this is not the best thing to say to someone. So that's changed. I also think people have become, and of course we're seeing this now play out on the national stage, angrier and angrier and frustrated. And it's only being...
replicated.
Yeah.
Every time you see it on the news, it's replicated.
And that has given people more license to speak to each other in ways that do not promote healthy dialogue.
Yeah.
And that's
why... Engage brain before opening mouth.
Yeah. But, so that part to me is hard, and that has changed. And I think a lot of that has to do with people's frustration and the economy. I do think that, middle class workers who work hard, play by the rules,
and they feel
forgotten. Send their kids to college, and they not only feel forgotten, I don't know if it's forgotten as much as they're working so hard and they're in the same place or not in the same place.
Instead of going ahead, they're either stationary or falling back.
Right. Yeah. And that is...
very frustrating.
Yeah, and I get that. And I get why that would make people angry or frustrated. And that is a huge problem that is global, I want to say, and national. There's so many things that are beyond your control.
And you know about them now. You didn't used to.
Right. Well, that was another thing about my job that I liked. is you had to learn a lot about a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. So one minute, a meeting with somebody on energy and electric rates, and the next thing I could be dealing is healthcare, health costs, mm-hmm. going to then talking about education issues, criminal justice system, and you can't, you have to
you
know
have to
something.
Learn. You have to learn. Yeah.
And then there are things that you have to learn that you would have absolutely no idea that you would have to learn. For instance, on the Environment Committee, I often tell students this. They said, well, Mrs. Willis, you know, what was the, you know, the most strangest thing, or I forgot how they, unusual thing? I said, I had to know how big a clamshell had to be before you could harvest it.
Oh, my word.
Because that's regulated by state law.
And we're so far away from the ocean, it's not even funny.
But I had to know if it's going to be an inch and a half or an inch and three quarters or 2 inches. And I had to listen to all the testimony and listen to all. And there are people who feel really strongly it should be 1.5 inches. And there's other people that say, no, no, you're taking too many young clams and out of... And it should be 1.75, you know. So.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah. So who knew? You know. So all kinds of, there are all kinds of things that, like what should be the state song, or, you know, the state insect, or, you know, really heavy duty. And people.
They get very strong. They're very passionate about these things.
Oh yeah, the state fish. I was part in when that bill came up. Do you know what the state fish is?
The trout.
Everybody says the trout.
What?
The shad. The Connecticut
River. Oh, the Connecticut shad, because of shad blows. Okay.
Yeah. And that's why we have
steel.
The shad. Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
Now you know.
Now I know.
Those are the kinds of critical issues I have been working on.
Before we close, is there anything that you'd like to add to this interview that I haven't covered?
No, I think we've done a
You've done a good job.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.